Professor Andrew Blakers, who is the Professor of Engineering at the Australian National University, spoke at an event in Maroochna several years ago, an event organised by the Shepparton-based group Slap Tomorrow. And now he's caught my attention again with an article on the conversation headed No Threat to Farmland. Just 1,200 square kilometres can fulfil Australia's solar and wind energy needs. He agreed to have a talk with me, and that was wonderful. And a board member from GV Community Energy, Terry Court, also agreed to join the conversation. Yes, welcome to this latest episode of Climate Conversations. I am your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to elders, past, present and emerging. Yes, let's listen now as Terry Court and I have a chat with Professor Andrew Blakers. Andrew, why did you write your last piece on the conversation, like No Threat to Farmland?
It was precipitated by some nutty analyses by some right-wing think tanks that the state of Victoria would be about the right size for the solar and wind farms required to decarbonise Australia. And I thought, that's probably wrong by a factor of 100 or 200. Let's just do the sums. And sure enough, it turned out that it is wrong by a factor of 100 or 200.
Mm. So has there been any response to what you wrote?
Yeah, there's been quite a few people who are interested in renewables saying, oh, thanks for doing those calculations. We knew that the area required is quite small, but it's nice to know that it's actually really very small. I haven't received any feedback from people who make exaggerated claims, and I don't expect any.
I wonder why politicians are dishing out so much misinformation about renewable energy. Do you have a view on that?
Because it's politically convenient to dish out misinformation, I guess, but you'd have to ask them about their motivation.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Just the other day I heard the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, heaping praise on the emissions-free nuclear power. So why is nuclear power inappropriate?
Well, it might or might not be appropriate, but nuclear failed in the environmental marketplace. So I would just like to illustrate that with the following information. There has been no change in nuclear capacity or nuclear generation worldwide in the last 13 years. It's been flat. It's neither growing nor shrinking. Every year, one or two power stations retire. One or two new ones are developed, mostly in China, but there's been no change. In contrast, solar has grown tenfold in the last 10 years. It's doubling every 3 years. It's now way past nuclear power in terms of capacity, and both solar and wind have now caught nuclear in terms of annual energy generation, and over the next 3 or 4 years will leave nuclear very far behind. In other words, solar and wind are growing rapidly. They're 99% of all new generation in Australia. Nuclear has no generation in Australia and is static around the world. So nuclear basically failed in the marketplace up against solar and wind.
Andrew, just yesterday I sat through a workshop that explained that when facts bump up to human behaviour, bump up against human behaviour, the latter, that's human behaviour, nearly always prevails. So can you tell me about your experiences in trying to convince people that the facts are correct, or the facts you present are correct, and that their behaviour stands in the way of progress?
It's difficult to persuade people to change strongly held views, even if the views are not grounded in fact. I had the benefit of a very good education in science, and in science, the number one requirement is that you follow the facts. No scientist who doesn't follow the facts will survive in a scientific environment. It's possible to not follow the facts in other environments where dogma can prevail over cold, hard reality. So I guess I wouldn't make a very good politician, because I don't want to tell fibs about things that I know are not correct. My job is to serve up how it is in reality, and hopefully there are people who are more skilled than I am at persuading others to follow the facts, not follow the ideology.
Andrew, you have some fascinating figures in your story about the area taken up by turbines, wind turbines and solar farms. They're all in the story, which I'll provide a link to. But are you able to take us through a few of them now, or is it too complex to do that?
Oh, no, it's quite straightforward. So the calculation I did showed that we need to alienate about 45 square metres of land per person to provide all of the solar and wind and storage and transmission needed to fully decarbonise the Australian economy. In other words, no more oil, gas or coal anywhere in the economy. That will alienate about 45 square metres per person, which is about the size of a large living room. This is about 3,000 times smaller than the area of land devoted to agriculture. So we're not, it's not a case of energy or agriculture. We can have both. So wind farms alienate very small amounts of land. It's just really the land around the turbine and the access road, which is about 1% of the area spanned by a wind farm. So when you see a wind farm, you see the turbines and the cows and the sheep and the crops continue between the turbines. And it's just the very small area around the turbine that you can't use for agriculture anymore. For solar farms, it's typically about a third of the land will no longer be useful for agriculture. But the space between the panel rows, of course, can continue for sheep grazing. And rooftop solar, of course, alienates no land at all.
Mm.
So it all adds up to about 45 square metres per person. And in a typical house, there's 200 square metres. So the roof area of a four-person house is equivalent to the area that you'd have to take out of agriculture to completely decarbonise Australia.
It was here that Terry Court, a board member with GV Community Energy, joined the conversation.
Yeah, Andrew, that's good. Look, the figure of 22,000 there, square kilometres, was it the in your article, which I haven't got in front of me now at the moment, but is that the total area? And then you've made these adjustments for wind farms and so forth and brings it back down to 1,200 square kilometres. Is that the way it works?
So the area of land that you take out of agriculture is about 1,200 square kilometres for Australia. The area that is inside the boundaries of the solar and wind farms is about 22,000 square kilometres. But most of that area, 95% of it, remains productive agricultural land. It's not lost to agriculture. Most of it is the space between the wind turbines.
All right. Well, what we've got, we're in an irrigation area here, right? So it's an arable land, and as I understand it, the amount of arable land in Australia is only about a little over 4% of the total land area. Now, and that's completely different than agriculture. Agriculture is probably something like 50%, right? So, and we've got this ongoing argument here that we mustn't impact on these high quality soils and our irrigation area. Have you got any sort of text you can put around that?
It's complete nonsense for several reasons. How dare a person walk onto another farmer's land and say, "You will not grow solar panels. Yes. You must grow wheat or sheep." Yep. I mean, how dare they? None of their business. Yep. If the farmer wants to be paid to host solar panels, that's the farmer's business. Yep. The market will sort it out. And the second aspect is that the area of arable land that would be occupied by solar farms is a very small fraction of 1%. It's one part in 3,000 for the agricultural land, and it's way sub 1% of the arable land. In all cases, the area of land is Small.
Yeah, and I think on that point, you know, arable land, if I look at it, we've got 307,000 square kilometres or something, and you're only saying we need 1,200, so that's only 0.34% of that arable land, let alone the 1,200 over the 3.6 million square kilometres, so that's a small percentage. In your figures, you know, Ross Garnaut and probably you, you know, we want to turn this country around, we want to actually process a lot more in this country, you know, whether it be green hydrogen or, you know, or green aluminium or green steel. Do your figures there in your 30 megawatts per 30 megawatt hours per year, do they include that growth or not?
They include complete decarbonisation. So that assumes that we triple electricity production in order to electrify transport, heating, industry, aviation and shipping. So electrifying transport is straightforward with electric vehicles and heating and cooling. You use electric heat pumps for industrial furnaces. You use electric furnaces. And for the chemical industry, that's metals, plastics, synthetic jet fuel, you use electrolysis of water to provide the hydrogen atoms. And that's, most of that is off-the-shelf technology. Electrolysis is not yet at industrial scale, but it will become more important. I don't believe that there will ever be large-scale sale of Australian energy, renewable or otherwise, to other countries. The reason is that almost all countries have far more solar and wind than they actually need. So future flows of energy from country to country akin to coal, oil and gas today will not happen because it's much cheaper to make your own energy on site. For example, Japan is often touted as a target for exports of Australian hydrogen. Well, Japan has about 45 times more offshore wind potential than it needs to be 100% renewable. And the losses involved in turning Australian electricity into hydrogen, then back into electricity in Japan, are so high. They're around about 80% of your energy throwaway. You can't afford to do that when you've got offshore wind in Japan at very, very good offshore wind at unlimited
scale. All right. So you're not a fan of hydrogen in the Australian economy?
Hydrogen is not going to participate much in the energy industry, but hydrogen atoms are absolutely required for the chemical industry. If you want to make ammonia or synthetic jet fuel, then you need hydrogen atoms. So we have to clearly distinguish between the energy industry, which will not have much hydrogen, and the chemical industry, which needs lots of clean hydrogen.
But you're also saying that there will not be a market for exportation of hydrogen in whatever form it might be, ammonia or whatever. That is a furphy. Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't put it that strongly, but there won't be export of hydrogen for energy applications in Japan, or not much anyway. There may be a significant export market of ammonia or synthetic jet fuel from many, many countries that have got great wind and sun, like the Middle East, Australia, Chile. There's many, many countries. So there'll be a lot of competition. Yep. And the chemical industry could benefit from, you know, sunny and windy place like Australia, but the energy industry will not.
All right then. Look, in the chemical industry, you've got two options, I suppose, or many more than two, but whether it be lithium or iron ore, it's all out in the... Yeah, in the outblocks of Australia. Do we actually, where do we do? Do we do that processing there, or do we bring that material back to the East Coast and have it adjacent to our population areas and also our renewable sources? Or do we just leave the status quo with the Pilbara or whatever?
I think that's a straight out commercial decision. Mm-hmm. Transmission is not very expensive, so you can... And solar and wind is available almost everywhere in Australia. So I don't think the question of energy supply is going to be significant. It's quite unlike the steel industry where you need to put iron ore and coal together to make steel. And coal is only found in a few places, like the iron ore is in the northwest, the coal is in the southeast, and you somehow got to get the two together. The iron ore is still in the northwest, but there's solar and wind everywhere. So she could do the iron ore processing or the manganese processing or the lithium processing. Wherever that it is convenient, you'll have access to solar and wind.
But we've got the problem then of alienating, you know, you've got forces, you know, workforces flying in, flying out and doing all those things. I'm not worried about the environmental impact of that, but there's a whole lot of consequences of that too. And that's why I thought maybe we would try and concentrate it a little bit closer, you know, to the eastern sort of side of Australia. So, well, not all of it, but just some of it where you say is economically, you know, practical, if you like.
Well, maybe, but of course we need. I observe that at the moment you put the lithium ore or cobalt or whatever on a ship, you can send that ship to China or Southeast Australia and do the processing in China or South Australia, and China has awesome solar and wind resources in the western part of China. So, as I said, most countries have all the solar and wind they would ever need. They will not need to rely on Australian energy.
Yeah, right. So the whole thing about Australia is, you know, the most got the most, if you like, energy per square meter, you know, solar energy. That is not necessarily correct, you're saying, or others.
No, it's not.
Oh, well, and a lot of us are actually saying that though. So whether it be Garno or Cannon Brooks or whatever. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, I observe that there's no clean hydrogen being made anywhere in Australia, as far as I know, or not in any significant commercial quantity, and there's no likelihood that that's going to happen anytime soon. There will be small markets for clean hydrogen. If you're a high-end car maker and you want to be able to boast that you're making clean steel, then you will be prepared to pay extra for a bit more for the steel that goes into your car, so you can say this is carbon-free steel. But if you're making structural steel by the megaton, then you can't afford to do that at the moment. Yep. You'll wait until the price of clean hydrogen comes down a little bit more before you start reducing your iron oxide using hydrogen instead of coke. But in the end, this is all commercial decisions. It's not.
That's right. And I heard last night, this is for someone like, they're taking, this is in Western Australia, they are looking very closely at a large hydrogen facility, and they're going to use seawater. And I thought the desalinisation of the seawater would be a major impediment. But I was advised last night that it's a very small part of the whole process. Yeah, so that, and that's new to me, though.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, reverse osmosis is not expensive. But also just remember that there's been a lot of talk about exporting hydrogen for a long time and it hasn't happened. We need to get this in perspective. There's three stages in decarbonising the global economy. The first stage is to decarbonise your electricity system using solar and wind. And Australia is well on track. We'll be at 82% renewable electricity by 2030. The second stage, which overlaps with the first one, is to decarbonise transport, heating and industry, because this is all low-cost, off-the-shelf technology. It's heat pumps, it's electric furnaces and it's electric vehicles. The third stage is really a job for the 2030s and 40s, and that's to decarbonise the chemical industry. That's where you need hydrogen. So working up to a major hydrogen industry for the chemical industry in the 30s and 40s is the strategy. But the job for the 2020s and the first part of the 2030s is decarbonise your electricity system, then use that clean electricity to decarbonise transport, heating and industry.
All right. Now, where do batteries play in? The technology with the batteries?
Well, batteries are a storage method. There's dozens of storage methods. There's batteries, there's pumped hydro, there's in-factory thermal stores, there's hot water systems, and they will all be important, and it's not one or the other, it's all together.
What about the actual ingredients of the battery? Is there anything there that you think is going to be the, you know, the battery might be different for a household battery or a grid-connected battery or whatever, but, you know, vanadium or some such like that, where do you think the balance will be there in battery technology in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, as you say, there's lots of different battery chemistries. There's lithium, there's lead acid, there's vanadium redox, there's Yeah, there's many, many different battery technologies, and they'll all find their appropriate market if you stand back and let the market sort it out. There's also, if you like, water batteries. That's called pumped hydro, which is, you know, it's only 97% of global energy storage for the electricity industry at the moment. And Australia has got three existing pumped hydro systems. That two more are being constructed. I mean, Snowy 2.0 is bigger than all of the utility batteries in the whole world put together. So if you want serious energy storage, you go to pumped hydro. If you want short-term high-power storage, you use batteries. If you want electric vehicles, you use batteries. So depends what you need, and that's the sort of battery you go for.
I'll hand it back to Rob. Go for it, Rob. Thanks very much, Andrew. Very good.
Thanks, Terry. Andrew, you talked about at one stage land alienated and area spanned. Can you explain that for me?
So land alienated means the land can't be used for agriculture anymore. So if you've got a road or if you've got a turbine tower, you can't farm that land. If you're directly under the solar panel, there's no sunshine coming through, so you can't farm that land. But the area in between the turbine towers and in between the solar panels, you can farm. So that's the area alienated is the area lost to agriculture. The area spanned is, if you like, the perimeter fence of the solar farms and wind farms. And the land inside that fence, most of it can continue to be used for agriculture.
Andrew, I enjoyed your article. Is there something else you would like to say about it?
Yes, I'd just like to say that Australia is the global pathfinder for renewables, surprisingly. And the basic reason for this is that by an accident of history, Australia has got an open electricity market. Anyone can connect into the electricity system if they meet basic technical specs. Most countries, certainly our neighbours, have a government monopoly, and that does not allow price discovery. The open market we've got allowed price discovery, and for the last decade, it's been very clear that solar and wind beat coal and gas for new generation. So we are now at 40% solar and wind and a bit of hydro, existing hydro. We'll be at 82% in 6 years' time, and then we'll continue on to 90 and 100% while we electrify transport, heating and industry. So this free market price discovery actually works. We live in a market economy. Stand back and let the market sort it out. So having politicians come in and say we need to do nuclear power, we need to stop renewables, is bizarre, in particular coming from a supposedly market-oriented political party. It's really quite bizarre. Stand back and let the market sort it out. The market has rejected nuclear. It's gone nowhere in the last dozen years, whereas solar and wind have been doubling every 3 years. The market is speaking very clearly.
Point on that with the American, I've forgotten the name of it, the enormous incentives that the American economy is now got available to us, and we announced something a couple of weeks ago, which is nowhere near, you know, it's chicken feed really compared to what the Americans are doing. But how important are those initiatives?
Terry was asking about America's Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA.
No, not very important. I mean, Australia is far ahead of the United States in terms of solar and wind per person, because for all the large size of the government money flowing in, it's chicken feed compared with the private money that has to go in to actually make it happen. All of the rooftop solar systems in Australia are with private money. All of the wind farms are with private money. All of the solar farms are private money. Australia is spending of order 10 or 15 billion per year in private money to build private solar farms, wind farms, and rooftop solar. Where government is important is in helping get the transmission built to bring the new solar and wind power into the cities. And this is not a financial issue. It's the fact that you need to get the transmission to traverse hundreds of farming properties in order to go from the solar and wind farms into the cities. Whereas, you know, building a solar or wind farm, the developers just need to negotiate with three or four farmers. It's a very different proposition. You can leave that to the private market, but transmission can't be. And there has been, I think, a concerted political campaign by people who don't believe in climate change, don't like renewables, to make transmission easements as difficult as possible. And I think the role of government right now is to say simply, we need to do this. We just need to do this. We're going to do it. There's very generous payments to farmers, $200,000 per kilometre. I think if I owned land, I would ask them to come across my land and just put a few zigzags in so I can get $400,000 per kilometre.
I'm from the water industry and we put an extensive irrigation system in and drainage system in. And we had compulsory acquisition powers. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any system, right?
And so it is with transmission. Yeah. You can,
and I would have thought we should be doing that, you know, this is a comment, we should be doing that sooner than later. Trying to rely on everyone to sort of be part of this, because it only takes one landowner to hold out or whatever, go to the High Court or do whatever, and the whole thing's crippled. So,
That's right, yes. And it's like anything. If you, in the end, the government sometimes has to step in and say, we're just going to do it. And climate change is such an imperative, we cannot afford to just have this held up. I mean, I live in suburbia. I look out my back window, I'm looking right now, and guess what?
Yeah,
I've got a power line going right across my back line.
Yeah.
And I've even got a power pole on my
property. Probably a railway line
too. Should I jump up and down and say, I object, I don't agree to this? Well, I think people in rural areas just have to get a bit real. If they want to have electricity and all of the benefits that flow from electrical systems, they have to accept this. And by saying no wind power or no transmission in my backyard, they're effectively saying, but I want to put it in somebody else's backyard.
Yeah, and I think I've had discussions with people and say, the money, we don't need the money. We just don't want the damn thing. It's 600 metres away. We don't want to look at it. So, and that's...
Well, my heart bleeds. I mean,
yeah.
The transmission I can see is 6 metres away from me.
Yeah, all right. No, I think, we've got a lot to, because there's so much, the figures that you've put out here are fantastic, because there's so uninformed people here about the percentage. Someone told me that 70% of the land in Australia is going to be covered with renewable. It's the biggest load of rot I've ever known. But
you could power the
world and beyond.
The entire world, plus half a dozen other worlds. Civilizations
That's right.
as well.
Yeah, and it's hard to combat. It's a difficult thing. But just once that information, and they've got the wrong information, it's very hard for people to say, maybe I got that wrong. So this is why your paper and we've got to push this too. You know, and I've been saying all here locally, it's less than 1%. That we need to run our energy here, and that's right. But and that's sort of in line with what it's in the same ballpark anyhow, because we're in an arable land here, from that point of view. But anyhow, I'll hand it back to Rod.
Just to take that point a bit further, how dare somebody walk onto somebody else's property and say, you will not accept thousands and thousands of dollars in lease fees for solar panels? I mean, what business is it of theirs?
Yeah, well, it's not. But the problem is the farming community are very tight-knit and they don't like letting someone down. And we're in a very conservative area here, right? And it's been hard go with water reform, for argument's sake, right? That's been a battle of nearly 20 or 15 years anyhow. So once they dig in, it's pretty hard to change their mind. And this renewable energy aspect, is there something else they're going to... They're digging in, or some people are anyhow, and we've got to provide the facts and hopefully they'll change their mind, or we compulsory acquire.
Well, I think there's a lot of jealousy in here as well. If you are hosting 4 or 5 megawatt wind turbines, you're going to get paid several tens of thousands of dollars per turbine per year. If you're hosting transmission, you're going to get paid $200,000. But if you're not hosting it, you don't. So I think there's a lot of jealousy from those who are sitting in good solar and wind and transmission zones and those who are not.
All right, I'll hand it back to Rob.
Well, thanks, Andrew. Andrew, I think we're pretty much out of questions, so thanks very much for talking with us. That was great.
Great. All right, then. Thank you.
Yes, once again, thank you, Andrew. That was perfect. And I urge you to check out the show notes and you'll look for his story, No Threat to Farmland, Just 12,000 Square Kilometres Can Fulfil Australia's Solar and Wind Energy Needs. Check it out. Also, there's special thanks to Terry for squeezing into my rather small studio, if I dare call it that, and help me with the interview. Well done, Terry. I appreciated that. Now, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. Now, don't forget to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. And beyond that, I'd love to hear from you. I want to know what you think about this podcast, so please contact me via email and tell me what you think. Good or bad, don't hold back. Please let me know. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast. So again, contact me at that same email address and I can contact you either by phone or over Zoom, and we can talk about your concerns about the climate crisis. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe.